We come now to Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and there are about six sections, or there are six sections that I want to look at in this chapter. We are not going to look at the whole chapter because there's too much detail in this chapter to look at in a hurried manner. And therefore, we're going to look at the chapter over two Wednesday evenings, the Lord willing. We're going to limit our attention this evening to the opening seven verses, and that will be quite sufficient to occupy us for the rest of the evening, I think. These seven verses, the opening seven verses, they divide into two manageable parts. Verses 1 to 3 speak of our approach to God and how we are to approach and how we are not to approach when you go into the house of God. And then from verse 4 to 7, we have a series of verses dealing with the issue of making and keeping vows. So you can see that there's a fairly meaty topic or topics before us, and that's one of the reasons why we're going to limit our attention to these opening verses this evening. Indeed, some of the verses in this chapter could be isolated and taken up as a short text, and I'm sure many a fine preacher could do a good job with the deep things that are mentioned in this chapter. But we're going to be looking at the big picture once again, and we're not going to spend over much time pausing and looking in great detail. We're looking at the big picture, trying to get the flow of the preacher's sermon. Some of the commentators say that he is preaching a series of sermons. Some say there are three sermons, and some say there are four sermons contained in this book of Ecclesiastes. I am not of a mind to argue the point. He does identify himself, after all, as the preacher, and therefore, in some senses, he is conscious that what he is presenting is preachable. But how many sermons he would make out of it, I wouldn't begin to know. So we're going to look at it as best we can in the way that we think is perhaps most manageable and suitable for our circumstances. So the opening three verses deal with our approach to God. And the scholars tell us that there are two different ways of interpreting verses 1 to 3. And there are those who take the view that these verses 1 to 3 in fact contain a warning about the wrong way to approach the house of God. And when you look at these verses, of course, it's obvious that there is a warning embedded in these words. Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God. Don't be like a fool when you come into the house of God. So there's no question that there is a warning in these verses. But then there are others who take the other side of this interpretation, or the opposite side, and say, yes, there is a warning, but the main thrust is not to warn us so much as to instruct us how we are to approach the house of God. So what I want to do this evening is to look first of all at verses 1 to 3 in terms of the warning. And then I want to come back to verses 1 to 3 and look at these words in terms of the directive, or a good advice, instruction, as to how it is that we are to approach the house of God. And then in the third place this evening, we shall, if we have time, we shall make comments about making and keeping vows. And so we have warnings and instructions embedded right throughout these opening seven verses, because even in verses 4 to 7, where we are dealing with vows, there is a warning undergirding the teaching there. Don't make vows rashly and foolishly, and if you make a vow, then be sure that you keep the vow, and don't go back on it, so to speak. And there's also instruction how to make vows. So there's plenty here from a practical theological point of view. So let's look at these opening three verses, first of all, in terms of prohibitions or in terms of warnings, how not to come to the house of God. And notice the wording. Keep thy feet. In other words, be careful. Guard. Don't just rush in unthinkingly. Be very cautious and be very careful when you go into the house of God. Be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools. And that particularly seems to refer to the opening up of our mouth in our praises, in our prayers, perhaps in our preaching, just as it were giving something that is described as a sacrifice, but really of fools, not of the wise man. For they consider not that they are doing evil. There is an evil way to approach the house of God. Be not rash with thy mouth. Let not thy heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven and thou art upon the earth. Therefore let thy words be few. Don't be, as it were, tumbling over endless mouthings. Let your words be very few. For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by the multitude of words. And then you will notice in verse 7 also, preacher mentions dreams. In verse 3 and in verse 7, he refers to dreams. And what he seems to be referring to in these verses, for a dream comes through the multitude of business, is wayward thinking, coming into the house of God, and your thoughts are occupied, you're daydreaming about the business of the day and the business of the morrow. In other words, you're not dealing with the business of the occasion of coming into the house of the Lord. And again in verse number 7, he says, for in the multitude of dreams and many words, there are also different kinds of vanities. So it's easy to, as it were, make vows to God, but our mind is really not thinking about what it is we're saying. We're daydreaming, as it were. So here we are being warned by the preacher not to be coming into the house of the Lord in a hasty manner and in a daydream where we're not really thinking very seriously of what it is that we are really doing when we come into the house of the Lord. Now, why does the preacher have to give this kind of stern warning? Well, it is obvious that he gives the stern warning because in his day, and in our day, and in every generation, there are people who come to the gatherings, they come to church, they come to the temple, they go to the mosque, or they go to the whatever it is they're going to pray their particular religious activities, and they're doing so in a rather casual kind of manner. So the writer is reminding us here that even a man who is a fool, who doesn't fear God, because the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and this is one of the wisdom books, and as we have seen already, there are those places, and later on when we come to the end of this chapter, we're going to see that there is wisdom, but the wisdom has to do with thinking right, using our knowledge properly, and walking in the fear of the Lord. But there are those who, as it were, like to worship. They like to come to places of worship, but they're not wise. They're actually fools. So what he is reminding us here is this, that the natural man doesn't mind a bit of religion now and again. He is quite prepared, in fact, to have a kind of regularity in religion. And he is rather hasty, as it were. It's almost as though he's hasting to come to the house of the Lord instead of being rather cautious. And he's eager, he's almost running to come. And he can't wait to get there to open his mouth to preach his sermon or to say his prayers or whatever it is he's going to do in the house of the Lord. And he's rushing into it. Now, we've got to face this fact that here, again, is one of those little portions of the scripture that warns us of the danger that the Bible warns us again, over and over again, right from Genesis, right through to Revelation, the terrible danger of false religion. Religion is in the heart of man. We are made for religion. We are made to be religion, to be religious. It is part of our nature. It is an instinct that seems to be in human nature. And whether we believe in the God of the Bible or not is irrelevant to the fact that we have a religious nature. And we do look to some mystique or some mysterious thing, something that is greater than ourselves. And the religious man, the man who is specifically and outwardly and consistently religious, he sees religion not so much as coming into the house of God in order to fall down and to worship before God and to give God his due, but rather to speak to God and be eager to tell God perhaps all about his sins, for example. And when he prays the prayers that everybody else has prayed before him. He's learned how to pray because he's listened, and when it comes time for him to pray, he's got it off pat. He is very hasty. He doesn't have to meditate or think about what he's going to say, because he's rash with his mouth. He just utters the words that are the, as it were, the current language of the prayer group to which he particularly belongs. Now that is characteristic of the natural man's hasty religion. And that is why Jesus warns us in Matthew chapter 6, for example, of the prayers of the heathens. When you pray, he says, don't be like the heathen. The heathen pray. And sometimes even the godless, the people who are not particularly attached to any kind of religion, there are times when people feel the need to pray. And I've got no doubt, we know from some of the interviews with politicians who are anything but godly, they're asked the question, what is their religion? Well, we don't have much, but do they pray? Well, we're praying, and we're praying that we're going to get in at the next election. They have said that on television. And we know from the book of Jonah, for example, that in the storm, every man prayed to his own God. These were rough sailors, and they probably hardly ever thought about prayer. But an emergency came, and they began to pray to whatever God it was that they had in their imagination. So prayer is something that men regard as something that is helpful at times. And the whole approach to God, worship is seen as a kind of a social cement. It's a kind of a status symbol for some people. And they put in their resume that they are churchgoers. And you will find, and I find it very often as a minister, for example, when I'm in new company, and inevitably the question of religion comes up simply because of my occupation in life. And you'll find that everybody professes some kind of interest and activity in religion. They've all got some kind of sympathy with religion. Nobody, it seems, wants to be, or very few people, it seems, want to be irreligious. And so this question of religion comes up over and over and over again. And there are even atheists who believe that there's a certain sense in which religion seems to be quite good for society. And I was reading recently of an atheist in England, a well-known atheist. I won't mention his name, but he is an atheist. And he was writing, and he was making the comment that he thought that the best thing for Africa today, he's talking about Africa, contemporary Africa, and his opinion was that what Africa needs today is the reintroduction of Christianity. Now, this man doesn't believe in Christianity. He doesn't believe it's true, but he does mean that it has good fruit. And what he was speaking about, of course, was the chaotic state of Africa. I don't know if you know what is happening in Africa, but Africa in many ways is gone to pot and gone to pieces. And when colonialism came to an end, and that wasn't a bad thing in itself, the old tribalism that was always underneath, the old tribal enmities and competitiveness for land and who owns what part of the continent and all these kinds of, it's all resurfaced again. And there are all these nations and they're changing their boundaries. And this man is making the point that when Christianity was introduced, these heathen religions were in a measure suppressed. They were never destroyed. They were always there. But nonetheless, the Christian culture influenced the continent as a whole. And it was a good thing. And we're now seeing the fruits of a departing Christian gospel. There are plenty of missionaries, as you well know, in Africa. And we're not saying that Christianity has totally died out, but it needs a good dose more of it. And that comes from the mouth of an atheist, because he is recognizing that there is something that is socially stabilizing. There is something that seems to bring a measure of decency into people's lives, and that is religion. But it need not be a God-fearing, Bible-believing and Bible-obeying religion. There was a famous British Prime Minister of a former generation by the name of Harold Macmillan. And I don't think that he professed to be a Christian, but he was commenting on the state of Britain after the Second World War. And he was saying that Britain, as it were, went into a moral decline in the 1950s, and especially in the 1960s, when people stopped going to church. That was his comment. Now, he is not a churchman. He's a politician. But he is concerned for the welfare and the stability and the peace of the political body. And he was saying that church going seems to be something that is stabilizing in a community. Now, it's this kind of thing, you see, that the preacher is commenting on, because he knows that people can go to church and they can say their prayers and they can do whatever it is they're expected to do. But he says it doesn't mean anything, or it may not mean anything. Ultimately, they are acting like fools because God is not impressed. They are not true believers. They are too hasty, he says, to offer their sacrifices. And they are forgetting that God is not there at their convenience. He is in heaven and they are upon the earth. Very often prayers, even among evangelical, professing evangelical Christians, seem to be kinds of prayers in which we are urging God to do what we want him to do, rather than recognizing that our praying to God is not in order to get God to do what we want to do, but rather to bring us into a frame of mind where we are willing to do what God wants us to do. It may be God's purpose to revive his people. It may not be his purpose to revive our church. He may have no intention of that. And yet we would, I'm sure, want him to pray, want him to revive us. No question of that. I would want him to revive us. But he may not wish to do so. And in praying about revival, we have to be very careful that we're not almost, as it were, crying to God, commanding God to do what we want him to do it, and to do it the way we expect him to do it. But rather, not my will, but thy will be done. Prayer was never intended to get God to become, as it were, our servant, our great pal in the sky, and there at our convenience. Rather, always it is that prayer is meant to bring us into subjection. And when we confess, when we adore, when we give thanks, when we make supplication, it is always in the recognition God may wish to do it, he may not wish to do it. It doesn't matter. Thy will be done. Thy kingdom come. And unto God's name be the glory. And so here is a picture, a warning of false religion. Don't be rash with thy mouth. Don't just repeat the old prayers over and over again. That's the way the heathen pray, according to Jesus. Be not like the heathen who think that they are heard for their many words, but rather pray in this manner. And you remember the Lord's Prayer, or the Lord's model prayer, is in fact a rather brief prayer. And when you look at the outline of that prayer, you find that the great concerns of the Lord's model prayer are, first of all, with God, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done upon the earth. And only then do we begin to speak about our own request for daily bread, forgiveness of sins, forgiving hearts, being delivered out of evil, led into the paths of righteousness. God first, and then ourselves later on in the petitions. So here there is a terrible tendency on the part of the natural man not to be willing to listen to what God has to say, but rushing in imperiously, and woe betide God if he doesn't listen to what we've got to say. Dietrich Bonhoeffer has something very pertinent to say about this. He says that we're to be very careful that we listen to men and we listen to God. Because if we do not listen to what men are saying to us in their cries, very soon we won't be listening to God. And if we're not listening to God, then we will reach the stage where we're not really listening to men either. We're not listening because we're doing too much talking. We want to talk all the time, not listening. We are told here to be more eager to listen and rather than speak. Be not rash with thy mouth. Let not thy heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, thou art upon the earth. Therefore let thy words be few. Don't be giving the sacrifice of fools, says the preacher. So there are these warnings. Don't be just praying without really thinking, rushing through it. The quicker this is over and done with. Not listening to long expository sermons, becoming impatient with certain aspects of teaching, feeling a kind of irksome rejection and resentment against the Word of God. That's false worship. Be very careful what you're doing. Be prepared to come to the house of the Lord. I wonder how many of us here tonight have prayed for the meeting tonight, prayed for one another, prayed for the preacher, prayed for the Word. Or have we just come because we've always come? If we have just come because we've always come, can it be that this Word is giving to us a gentle reminder and a rebuke that we are actually coming into the house of the Lord in the wrong manner? This is the kind of thing, this is the kind of challenge. There's a sermon in that in itself, and I don't have any more time to comment any further about the warning against falsely or in a false manner coming into the house of the Lord. For a dream comes through the multitude of business, thinking about all the business. We're daydreaming about the profit and the loss of today's business, yesterday's and tomorrow's, wandering in our thoughts, thinking about everything except what is in hand as we come into the house of the Lord. That's what he's warning. But then there's another way that we can look at these words, and it is that they actually contain a directive when we come into the house of the Lord. And notice how he begins by cautioning us to come thoughtfully, to come carefully, to come, as it were, rather slowly, diffidently almost, with fear and trembling. It be more ready to hear. Don't be too quick to speak to God without, first of all, being eager to hear what God has to say to us. I think there is always the danger that we are, as it were, not so ready to hear. Sometimes we are too quick to speak, and we must be ready to hear. And it's interesting how the man is the preacher. This is a preachable book of the Bible. And right throughout the scriptures, we find that there is the preachability of the Word of God. The prophets were preachers. Jesus Christ was a preacher. This king in Jerusalem is a preacher. The apostles were preachers. The gospel is to be preached in all the world. And James Denny, one of the great Scottish divines of a previous generation, he puts it like this. He says, when we read the gospels, he says, when we think of Christ coming into the world, how are we to understand the coming of Christ in relationship to the preaching of the gospel? He says that we are to be, Christ did not come, he says, in order to preach the gospel so much as he came in order that there might be a gospel to preach. Now, he is bang on the ball there, because there is no new teaching in the teaching of Christ. It was all said in the prophets. The great ministry of Christ was not in his preaching and teaching. He elaborated what the prophets, Moses and the prophets, had said. He explained it in a way that the scribes and the Pharisees were not able to explain it. They had lost the meaning of their Old Testament scriptures. Jesus was reintroducing it, but he wasn't reintroducing something that was different to what Moses and the prophets had said. He spoke nothing except what was based upon the teaching of the prophets. But what he did come to do was to do something that Moses and the prophets had never dreamed and were never able to do. He was to give his life as a ransom for many. And the message of the Christian gospel is not the teaching of Christ as such. The Sermon on the Mount is not the gospel. The Sermon on the Mount is the exposition of the law. You have heard that it was said, I say unto you. All the Beatitudes are found in the Old Testament. The teaching on marriage and divorce and lying, all these things, they're all found in the Old Testament. Jesus was not introducing any new doctrine. He was simply expounding the inner and the wider and the higher meaning of the law. You have heard, but this is what I say. This is what it really means. The gospel is that God loved the world and gave his Son to be the substitutionary sacrifice for the sins of the world. That he rose, he died on the cross of Calvary. He was buried. He rose again on the third day. That is the gospel. That he is coming again in glory. That is the gospel. Paul reminded the Corinthians of the gospel. That gospel which I preach unto you. He said, by which you are saved, if you keep it in memory, what I also preached unto you. And what was the gospel? Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. He was buried. On the third day he rose again according to the scriptures. That is the gospel. And so what we have here is a readiness to hear, not what we are going to say to God, but what is God going to say to us? Be not rash with thy mouth. Let not thy heart be hasty to utter anything before God. And the reason why there has to be this, as it were, almost reservedness in the presence of the Lord is because of the vast difference between what we are and what God is. For God is in heaven and you are upon the earth. Therefore, keep, let thy words be few. Don't be overconfident and over loquacious in the presence of the One. He belongs to a higher dimension. He's in heaven. If you and I were to be brought into the presence of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, I think that we would not be overmuch hasty to give her our opinions on things and tell her what we wanted to do, what we wanted her to do for us. I think we would be much more respectful than that. And I think we would get very short shrift from Her Majesty were we to speak to her in that rather familiar and indeed impudent manner. And yet, very often we seem to think nothing about speaking to God in those hasty, almost overconfident terms. Remember, He doesn't belong to our little realm of existence. He is in heaven. You're upon the earth. You're a creature of the dust. That's what we are, as the previous chapter has reminded us. We are simply like animals. We have an animal body. We belong to the primates. We are mammals in that sense, biologically. But we're not just animals, we're made in the image of God. That's the distinction. We belong to the higher order, but we also belong to the lower order of animal life. Our breathing is the same as the breath of animals. Therefore, be rather humble concerning ourselves. We're not all that great. We're not angels. We are made a little lower than the angels. And therefore, humility in the presence of the great Creator and controller of all things becomes us. Let thy words be few. For a dream comes through the multitude of business. Well, let's not daydream in God's presence. Let's concentrate on what God the Lord is saying. Let us concentrate on what the Word of God is actually saying to us. Because to do otherwise is to enter into the worship of fools, according to this passage. A fool's voice is known by the multitude of vows. The multitude of words. So we have these two different interpretations. And the scholars present both of them. I've presented both of these views because they are all contained there. Those who say that these first three verses are a warning, they are correct. But also those who say that these first three verses are a directive, they are also correct. And we need to explore the two ways. Don't do it this way, but do it that way. And the assumption is this, that just because we're not to do it in the wrong way doesn't mean we're not to do it at all. Just because something is done in a wrong manner doesn't mean to say we're to abstain from doing it. We're to do it the right way. The corrective in the Bible is not abstaining from things, but doing things correctly. It's like the Lord's Supper. When Paul was writing to the Corinthians, they were abusing the Lord's Supper. Some of them were even getting drunk. And they didn't even seem to know the meaning of the resurrection, for example. And they didn't seem to recognize the Lord's body. And Paul is saying to them, now it's not a matter of don't take the bread and the wine and eat. He says, take the bread, let him eat of that bread, let him drink of that cup, but do it properly. And it's the same in worship. Just because worship is characterized in so many instances by wrong motives and wrong activities, it doesn't need to say we're to abandon worship, but we're to come to worship the Lord in the manner that he requires of us, and in the only manner that he will receive from us. Let us not be hasty. Let's not come to these midweek meetings prayerless, thoughtless, busy with the busyness of the day's business. That is to come with the offering of fools, but come with a cautious, careful, humble, reverential approach. And speak what we have to speak. Say what is on our hearts and leave it there. The man who went down to his house justified. In Luke's gospel, all he said was, God be merciful to me, the sinner. He was to the point. He just stated his case and left it there. And he went home, and he went home justified rather than the other man who made pretentious prayers typical of a Pharisee. So that's the first three verses in this chapter. And then the next verses, 4, 5, 6, and 7, deal with the offering of vows. Now, there's no question that the worship that is mentioned in verses 1 to 3 is intimately connected with the offering of vows, because it is often in the context of worship, not always, but often it is in the context of worship that we do make our vows to the Lord. And when we hear the Lord speaking, we are maybe challenged and to consider our ways, and we say, well, yes, I must see to that, and from now on I'm going to change my ways. And yes, under the preaching of the word, we can make new resolutions about things that we will no longer continue to do and things that we will now begin to do. And often it's under the word, in the house of the Lord, so to speak, that we make these vows to the Lord. So let's look at these verses very briefly. When you make a vow, he says, to God, do not defer to pay it. In other words, don't hesitate to put it into practice. For he has no pleasure, that is, God has no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better it is that thou should not vow, that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin. Neither say thou before the angel, that is, the messenger, and the scholars think that this probably means possibly the priest or the officer in the temple or in the house of the Lord who is on duty. So we suddenly turn to this officer in the church, so to speak, and we say, well, I made a vow, you heard me make the vow, but I didn't really mean it. It was a mistake. So if I don't pay the vow, don't come and accuse me. There are those who take that kind of view. And I think that seems to make sense when you look at the various translations of this verse. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel. There are those who say it means an angel literally, but as you know, the word angel can mean a messenger, and the scholars differ on that point. But I think that possibly a temple attendant or something similar would be probably what it means. It was an error. Don't say it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thy hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there are also various vanities. But fear thou God. Always fear God. Now, there's no question, when we read through the scriptures, we find that the issue of vows comes up quite a lot. And vows are oaths, promises to do or not to do, to give or whatever. These are oaths that are taken under solemn circumstances, and they are oaths in the name of the Lord. You find this in the law of Moses on quite a number of occasions. When you vow, you have to vow and make your oath in the name of the Lord. In other words, you're to invoke God's name. He is a witness as to the sacredness of what you're undertaking to do. And the danger here is that we will make a vow in haste, a rash vow, and then regret making that vow. The vow may well have been a lawful vow in itself, but we did it in the wrong way. And we now regret making that vow because perhaps we see it's going to inconvenience us. We saw a couple of Sunday evenings ago, you remember, in our study in Psalm number 15, who shall dwell in God's holy temple? Who will dwell with the Lord? And one of the characteristics was that the man who made a vow, or he swore, he would swear to his own heart. If he promised to do it, and then he found that doing the vow, performing the vow, was going to cost him perhaps more than he had calculated, he would stand by the vow. He wouldn't break the vow. That's the characteristic of the man who is going to stand in God's holy temple. The man who makes vows easily, as Mary Poppins says, a pie crust promise, easily made, easily broken, that man is making a vow. And God is angry with that kind of man, because that's the vow of a fool. That's the vow of a man who does not really fear the Lord. He doesn't care really whether he breaks his word or he does not. Now we have to be clear. There are some vows that can be broken. And the reason that they can be broken is because they should never have been made in the first place. Vows under duress, for example, under torture. Vows under pressure. Vows made in ignorance. Vows made out of fear, where you're forced to make a vow, where some strong arm man twists your arm and makes you swear to do something. That vow, even in a court of law, is not legally binding. And even if you are forced, for example, to make a confession, and if it can be demonstrated that that confession was wrought out of you by duress, that does not become legitimate evidence in a court of law. Every vow, every signature, every witness, every testimony has to be a free will, knowledgeable, committed testimony, where in your right mind and in fullness of your senses, understanding what you're doing, you are then under obligation to make and to keep that vow. God holds you to your word. Some marriages, for example, made under duress, are not really binding in the eyes of the Lord, for the simple reason that these marriages should never have taken place in the beginning. There are all kinds of exceptions, and there are vows. We are not obligated to keep every single vow in that sense. We are not obligated, for example, to keep a vow that for the rest of our days we're going to be atheists. Those people of whom we read in the Acts of the Apostles, when they banded themselves together under a vow that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. Well, I don't know if they died of starvation and thirst, whatever, I don't know. But that was not a lawful vow to make. And any one of those who were engaged in that kind of conspiratorial vow, they should have felt quite free to break that vow, because that was not a God-sanctioned vow to make. So we've got to be clear that in making vows, there are some vows that are really not meant to be kept, because they were never really vows in the first place, in the proper sense. But on the other hand, if we do make a vow in the name of the Lord, and if we find later on that it's going to cost us something, God will hold us to that vow. And we have no business, the writer is saying to us, to turn suddenly to a witness, perhaps the angel or the messenger in the temple, and say, well, really, I didn't really mean it. It was a mistake. When, in fact, it was not a mistake. If it was not a mistake when we made the vow, then don't turn to a witness and say, well, I didn't really mean it, and I want you to get me off the hook. That's what's being said here. Neither say thou before the angel, it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thy hands? God will destroy those who make vows in his name, taking his name in vain, and then having no intention, or when it's inconvenient, to keep that vow. And that's why we've got to be very careful. That's one of the reasons to be careful what we say. If you don't intend to do it, then don't say you'll do it. Don't tell somebody that you will pray for them if you have no intention of praying for them. Don't tell somebody that you'll see them or visit them or whatever if you have no intention of doing it. It's better not to vow, says the preacher, than to make a vow and then not keep it. I will pay my vows unto the Lord, says the psalmist, Psalm 116. And part of the resolution to keep that vow to the Lord was, what shall I do for God? Because for all his benefits to me, I'll take the cup of salvation. And I'll stick with the cup of salvation. I'll make a vow that from now on the cup of salvation is going to be my possession. And I will stand by that vow. That's a good vow to make. I will keep that vow. I will make it and keep it. I will keep it before all his people. That's what the psalmist is saying. That's the kind of vow that is pleasing unto the Lord. So here, the topic here is worshipping God in a right or in a wrong way, or making vows and taking oaths in a right or in a wrong way. Not daydreaming about it. For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there are also various vanities, emptinesses, foolishnesses and futilities. And this section closes with the wisest counsel that the Bible knows about. Fear God, because God is going to bring us all into account. Every idle word, not only the bad words, the curses, the swearing, the lies, idle words, every idle word. So be very careful. Be very cautious. Take thought. Be prayerful. Prepare our hearts before we come to the house of the Lord. And don't sing it if we don't mean it. I will praise thy name time without end. If we don't mean that, don't sing it. Because we're singing a vow to the Lord that perhaps tragically far too often is easily made and easily broken. That's the kind of issue. This book of Ecclesiastes is a philosophical book. And as you know, philosophy has to do with a way of thinking. It has to do with evidences, serious thinking, serious thought. How do we know things? How do we prove anything? And this most philosophical book of the whole of the Bible is a book that gets into us, if we allow it to do so, that is. But on the other hand, maybe we don't allow it to do so because we're not really listening to God at all. So these are issues. And they certainly challenge me. I'm finding as I go through this book, studying it for preparation and just for my own value, I'm finding that there are things here that are, as it were, almost like spiritual volcanoes. And very deep things. And I'm only sorry that we are not going to be looking at these things more profoundly. But nonetheless, we'll do the best we can in the time that we've got remaining. Well, we'll leave it there for this evening. May God bless his word.